Chapter 2. "And now," said Pongo Twistleton, crushing out his cigarette in the ashtray and speaking with a note of quiet satisfaction in his voice, "I shall have to be buzzing along. I've got a date." He'd been giving his uncle, Lord Ickenham, lunch at the Drones Club, and a very agreeable function he had found it. For the other, who, like Lord Emsworth, had graced the opening of Parliament with his presence, had been very entertaining on the subject of his experiences. But what had given him even more pleasure than his relative's mordant critique of the appearance of the four pursuivants, Rouge Croix, Blue Mantle, Rouge Dragon, and Portcullis, as they headed the procession, had been the stimulating thought that, having this engagement, he ran no risk at the conclusion of the meal of being enticed by his guest into what the latter called one of their pleasant and instructive afternoons. The ordeal of sharing these in the past had never failed to freeze his blood. The occasion when they'd gone to the dog races together some years previously remained particularly green in his memory. Of Frederick Altamont Cornwallis Twistleton, 5th Earl of Ickenham, a thoughtful critic had once said that in the late afternoon of his life he retained, together with a juvenile waistline, the bright enthusiasms and fresh, unspoiled outlook of a slightly inebriated undergraduate. And no one who knew him would have disputed the accuracy of the statement. As a young man in America, before a number of deaths in the family had led to his succession to the title, he had been, at various times, a cowboy, a soda jerker, a newspaper reporter, and a prospector in the Mojave Desert. And there was not a ranch, a drugstore, a newspaper office, or a sandy waste with which he had been connected that he had not done his best to enliven. His hair today was grey, but it was still his aim to enliven, as far as lay within his power, any environment in which he found himself. He liked, as he often said, to spread sweetness and light, or, as he sometimes put it, give service with a smile. He was a tall, distinguished-looking man with a jaunty moustache and an alert and enterprising eye. In this eye, as he turned it on his nephew, there was a look of disappointment and reproach, as if he expected better things from one of his flesh and blood.
"You're leaving me? Why is that? I've been hoping for—"
I know," said Pongo austerely. "One of our pleasant and instructive afternoons. Well, pleasant and instructive afternoons are off. I've got to see a man."
"About a dog?"
"Not so much about a dog as—"
"Phone him and put him off."
"I can't."
"Who is this fellow?"
"Bill Bailey." Lord Ickenham seemed surprised.
"He's back, is he?"
"Eh?"
"I was given to understand that he had left home. I seem to remember his wife being rather concerned about it."
Pongo saw that his uncle had got everything mixed up, as elderly gentlemen will. "Oh, this chap isn't really Bill. I believe he was christened Cuthbert. But if a fellow's name is Bailey, you've more or less got to call him Bill."
"Of course. Noblesse oblige. A friend of yours?"
"Bosom. Up at Oxford with him."
"Tell him to join us here."
"Can't be done. I've arranged to meet him in Milton Street."
"Where's that?"
"In South Kensington." Lord Ickenham pursed his lips.
"South Kensington, where sin stalks naked through the dark alleys and only might is right. Give this man a miss. He'll lead you astray."
"He won't jolly well lead me astray. And why? Because for one thing, he's a curate. And for another, he's getting married. The rendezvous is at the Milton Street Registry Office."
"You are his witness?"
"That's right."
"And who is the bride?"
"American girl."
"Nice."
"Bill speaks well of her."
"What's her name?"
"Shoemaker." Lord Ickenham leapt in his seat.
"Good heavens! Not little Myra Shoemaker?"
"I don't know if she's little or not. I've never seen her. But her name's Myra, all right. Why, do you know her?" A tender look had come into Lord Ickenham's handsome face. He twirled his moustache sentimentally.
"Do I know her? Many's the time I've given her a bath." Not recently, of course, but years ago, when I was earning my living in New York. Jimmy Schoonmaker was my great buddy in those days. I don't get over to God's country much now. Your aunt thinks it better otherwise. And I've often wondered how he was making out. He promised, when I knew him, to become a big shot in the financial world. Even then, though comparatively young, he was able to shoot a cigar across his face without touching it with his fingers, which, as we all know, is the first step to establishing oneself as a tycoon. I expect by this time he's the Wolf of Wall Street, and is probably offended if he isn't investigated every other week by a Senate commission. Well, it all seems very odd to me.
What's odd?
His daughter getting married at a registry office. I should have thought she would have had a big choral wedding with bridesmaids and bishops and all the fixings.
Ah, I see what you mean.
Pongo looked cautiously over his shoulder. No one appeared to be within earshot.
Yes, you would think so, wouldn't you? But Bill's nuptials have got to be solemnized with more than a spot of secrecy and silence. The course of true love hasn't been running too smooth. Hellhounds have been bunging spanners into it.
What hellhounds would those be?
I should have said one hellhound. You know her. Lady Constance Keeble.
What? Dear old Connie. How that name brings back fragrant memories. I wonder if you recall the time when you and I went to Blandings Castle, I posing as Sir Roderick Glossop, the loony doctor, you as his nephew, Basil.
I recall it,
said Pongo with a strong shudder. The visit alluded to had given him nightmares for months.
Happy days, happy days. I enjoyed my stay enormously and wish I could repeat it. The bracing air, the pleasant society, the occasional refreshing look at Emsworth's pig, it all combined to pep me up and brush away the cobwebs. But how does Connie come into it?
She forbade the banns.
I still don't follow the scenario. Why was she in a position to do so?
What happened was this. She and Schoonmaker are old pals. I got this from Bill, so I assume we can take it as accurate. And he wanted his daughter to have a London season, so he brought her over here and left her in Lady C's charge.
All clear so far.
And plumb spang in the middle of their London season, Lady C discovered that the Beazle was walking out with Bill. Ascertaining that he was a curate, she became as sore as a gumboil.
She does not like curates?
That's the idea one gets.
Odd. She doesn't like me either. Very hard to please, that woman. What's wrong with curates?
Well, they're all pretty hard up. Bill hasn't a bean.
I begin to see. Humble suitor. Curious how prejudiced so many people are against humble suitors. My own case is one in point. When I was courting your Aunt Jane, her parents took the bleakest view of the situation. And weren't their faces red when, one day, I suddenly became that noblest of created beings, an earl, a hell of a fella with four Christian names and a coronet hanging on a peg in the downstairs cupboard. Her father, scorning me because I was a soda jerker at the time, frequently, I believe, alluded to me as that bum, but it was very different when I presented myself at his Park Avenue residence with a coronet on the back of my head and a volume of Debrett under my arm. He gave me his blessing and a cigar. No chance of Bill Bailey becoming an earl, I suppose?
Not unless he murders about 57 uncles and cousins.
Which a curate, of course, would hesitate to do. So what was Connie's procedure?
She lugged the poor wench off to Blandings, and she's been there ever since, practically in durance vile, her every movement watched. But this Myra seems to be a sensible, level-headed girl, because learning from her spies that Lady C was to go to Shrewsbury for a hairdo and wouldn't be around till dinner-time, she phoned Bill that she would be free that day and would nip up to London and marry him. She told him to meet her at the Milton Street Registry Office, where the project could be put through speedily and at small expense.
I see. Very shrewd. I often think these runaway marriages are best. No fuss and feathers. After all, who wants a lot of bishops cluttering up the place? I often say, when you've seen one bishop, you've seen them all.
Lord Ickenham paused.
Well,
he said, looking at his watch,
I suppose it's about time we were getting along. Don't want to be late.
Pongo started. To his sensitive ears, this sounded extremely like the beginning of one of their pleasant and instructive afternoons. In just such a tone of voice had his relative a few years earlier suggested that they might look in at the dog races, for there was, he said, no better way of studying the soul of the people than to mingle with them in their simple pastimes.
We? You aren't coming?
Of course I'm coming. Two witnesses are always better than one, and little Myra...
I can't guarantee that she's little.
And Myra, whatever her size, would never forgive me if I were not there to hold her hand when the firing squad assembles.
Pongo chewed his lower lip, this way and that, dividing the swift mind.
Well, all right, but no larks.
My dear boy, as if I should dream of being frivolous on such a sacred occasion. Of course, if I find this Bill Bailey of yours unworthy of her, I shall put a stopper on the proceedings, as any man of sensibility would. What sort of chap is he? Pale and fragile, I suppose, with a touch of consumption and a tendency to recite the collect for the day in a high tenor voice?
Pale and fragile? My foot! He boxed 3 years for Oxford.
He did?
And went through the opposition like a dose of salts.
Then all shall be well. I expect I shall take the fellow to my bosom.
His expectation was fulfilled. The Reverend Cuthbert Bailey met with his instant approval. He liked his curates substantial, and Bill proved to be definitely the large economy size. The sort of curate whom one could picture giving the local backslider the choice between seeing the light or getting plugged in the eye. Amplifying his earlier remarks, Pongo, on the journey to Milton Street, had told his uncle that in the parish of Bottleton East, where he'd recently held a cure of souls, Bill Bailey had been universally respected, and Lord Ickenham could readily appreciate why. He himself would have treated with the utmost respect any young man so obviously capable of a sweet left hook followed by a snappy right to the button. A captious critic might have felt on seeing the Reverend Cuthbert that it would have been more suitable for one in holy orders to have looked a little less like the logical contender for the world's heavyweight championship, but it was impossible to regard his rugged features and bulging shoulders without an immediate feeling of awe. Impossible, too, not to like his manifest honesty and simplicity. It seemed to Lord Ickenham that in probing beneath the forbidding exterior to the gentle soul it hid, his little Myra had done the smart thing. They fell into pleasant conversation, but after the first few exchanges, it was plain to Lord Ickenham that the young man of God was becoming extremely nervous. Nor was the reason for this difficult to divine. Some 20 minutes had elapsed, and there were still no signs of the bride-to-be, and nothing so surely saps the morale of a bridegroom on his wedding day as the failure of the party of the second part to put in an appearance at the tryst. 10 minutes later, Bill Bailey rose, his homely features registering anguish.
"Isn't she coming?"
Lord Ickenham tried to comfort him with the quite erroneous statement that it was early yet. Pongo, also anxious to be helpful, said he would go out and cock an eye up and down the street to see if there were any signs of her. His departure from the room synchronized with a hollow groan from the suffering young man.
"I must have put her off."
Lord Ickenham raised a sympathetic but puzzled eyebrow.
"I don't think I understand you. Put her off? How?"
"By the way I spoke on the phone. You see, I was a bit doubtful of this idea of hers. It didn't seem right somehow that she should be taking this terrifically important step without thinking it over. I mean, I've so little to offer her. I thought we ought to wait till I get a vicarage.
I follow you now. You had scruples.
Yes.
Did you tell her so?
No, but she must have noticed something odd in my voice, because she asked me if I wasn't pleased.
To which you replied,
"Oh, rather."
Lord Ickenham shook his head.
Oh, you should have done better than that. Or did you say, "Oh, rather," emphasizing it and dragging it out, as it were, joyously, if you know what I mean, with a sort of lilt in the voice?
I'm afraid I didn't. You see,
I know, you had scruples. That's the curate in you coming out. You must fight against this tendency. You don't suppose young Lochinvar had scruples, do you? You know the poem about young Lochinvar?
Oh, yes. I used to recite it as a kid.
I, too. And to solid applause. Though there were critics who considered that I was better at "It Hwoth the Schooner Hesperoth that Sailed the Thormy Sea." I was rather short on front teeth in those days, but despite these scruples, you came to this marriage depot.
Yes.
And the impression you have given me is that your one desire is to have the registrar doing his stuff.
Yes.
You overcame your scruples.
Yes.
I quite understand. I've done the same thing myself. I suppose if the scruples I've overcome in my time were laid end to end, they would reach from London to Glasgow. Ah, Pongo,
said Lord Ickenham, as his nephew appeared in the doorway.
Anything to report?
Not a thing. Not a single female as far as the eye can reach. I'll tell you what occurred to me, Bill, as I was scanning the horizon.
Probably the very thing that has just occurred to me, said Lord Ickenham. You were thinking that Lady Constance must have changed her mind about going to Shrewsbury for that hairdo.
That's right. And with her on the premises, the Popsy...
Bill's rugged features registered displeasure.
I wish you wouldn't call her a Popsy.
With her on the premises, your ball of worsted would naturally be unable to make her getaway. You'll probably receive a letter tomorrow explaining the situation and making arrangements for the next fixture.
Yes, that must be it,
said Bill, brightening a little.
Though you'd have thought she would have wired,
he added, sinking into the depths again.
Lord Ickenham patted his burly shoulder paternally.
My dear chap, how could she? The Market Blandings post office is 2 miles from the castle, and, as Pongo says, her every movement is watched. She'll be lucky if you get so much as a letter through the lines without having it steamed open and intercepted. If I were you, I wouldn't worry for a moment.
I'll try not to,
said Bill, heaving a sigh that shook the room.
Well, anyway, there's no sense in hanging around here. This place gives me the creeps. Thanks for coming along, Pongo. Thanks for coming along, Lord Ickenham. Sorry your time was wasted.
My dear fellow, time is never wasted when it's passed in pleasant company.
No, no, there's that, of course. Well, I'll be off.
As the door closed behind him, Lord Ickenham sighed. Not so vigorously as Bill had done, but with a wealth of compassion. He mourned in spirit for the young cleric.
Too bad,
he said.
It's always difficult for a bridegroom to key himself up to going through the wedding ceremony, an ordeal that taxes the stoutest. And when he's done it, and the bride doesn't meet him halfway, the iron enters into the soul pretty deeply. And no knowing when the vigilance of the authorities will be relaxed again, I suppose, if ever. You don't make prison breaks easily when Connie is holding the jailer's keys.
Pongo nodded. He, too, mourned in spirit for his stricken friend.
No,
he said.
I'm afraid Bill's in a spot. And what makes the situation stickier is that Archie Gilpin's at Blandings.
Who?
the Duke of Dunstable's nephew.
Ricky Gilpin's brother?
That's right. You ever met him?
Never. I know Dunstable, of course, and I know Ricky, but this Archibald is a sealed book to me. Who told you he was a Blandings?
He did, in person. I ran into him yesterday, and he said he was off there on the afternoon train. Pretty sinister, it seemed to me.
Why is that?
Well, dash it. There he'll be, closeted with the girl, and who knows she won't decide to switch from Bill to him. He's a very good-looking bloke, which you can't say Bill is.
No, I would call Bill's an interesting rather than a beautiful face. He reminds me a little of one of my colleagues on the Wyoming ranch, where I held a salaried position in my younger days as a cowpuncher, of whom another of my colleagues, a gifted phrase-maker, said that he had a face that would stop a clock. No doubt Bill has stopped dozens. But surely the little Myra I used to wrap in a bath towel and dandle on my knee can't have grown up into the sort of girl who attaches all that importance to looks.
You never know. Girls do go for the finely chiselled. And apart from his looks, he's an artist, and there's something about artists that seems to act on the other sex like catnip on cats. What's more, I happen to know, because I met a fellow who knows the chap who knows her, that Archie's girl has just broken their engagement.
Indeed.
A girl called Millicent Rigby. Archie works on one of those papers Lord Tilbury runs at the Mammoth Publishing Company, and she's Tilbury's secretary. This fellow told me that the chap had told him that he had it directly from the Rigby wench that she had handed Archie the black spot. You see what that means?
Not altogether.
Use your bean, Uncle Fred. You know what you do when your girl gives you the push. You dash off and propose to another girl, just to show her she isn't the only onion in the stew.
Lord Ickenham nodded. It was many years since he'd acted in the manner described, but he, too, had lived in Arcady.
Ah, youth, youth,
he was saying to himself. And he shuddered a little as he recalled the fearful female down Greenwich Village way, all beads and bangles and matted hair, at whose sandaled feet he had laid his heart the second time Pongo's Aunt Jane had severed relations with him.
Yes, I follow you now. This does make Archibald a menace, and one cannot but feel a certain anxiety for Bill. Where can I find him, by the way?
He's staying with me at my flat. Why?
I was thinking I might look in on him from time to time and try to cheer him up. Take him to the dog races, perhaps.
Pongo quivered like an aspen. He always quivered like an aspen when reminded of the afternoon when he'd attended the dog races in Lord Ickenham's company. Though on that occasion, as his uncle had often pointed out, a wiser policeman would have been content with a mere reprimand. The canny peer of the realm, when duty calls him to lend his presence to the ceremony of the opening of Parliament, hires his robes and coronet from that indispensable clothing firm, the Brothers Moss of Covent Garden, whose boast is that they can at any time fit anyone out as anything and have him ready to go anywhere. Only they can prevent him being caught short. It was to their emporium that, after leaving his nephew, Lord Ickenham repaired, carrying a suitcase. And he had returned the suitcase's contents and paid his modest bill when there entered, also carrying a suitcase, a tall, limp, drooping figure, at the sight of which he uttered a glad cry.
Emsworth, my dear fellow, how nice to run into you again. So you too are bringing back your sheaves.
Huh?
Said Lord Emsworth, who always said,
huh?
When anyone addressed him suddenly.
Oh, hello, Ickenham. Are you in London?
Lord Ickenham assured him that he was, and Lord Emsworth said so was he. This having been straightened out,
Were you at that thing this morning?
He said.
I was indeed, said Lord Ickenham. and looking magnificent. I don't suppose there's a peer in England who presents a posher appearance when wearing the rich medallions and comic hat than I do. Just before the procession got underway, I heard Rouge Croix whisper to Blue Mantle, "Don't look now, but who's that chap over there?" And Blue Mantle whispered back, "I haven't the foggiest, but evidently some terrific swell." But it's nice to get out of the fancy dress, isn't it? And it's wonderful seeing you, Emsworth. How's the Empress?
Oh, capital, capital, capital. I left her in the care of my pigman, well-beloved, in whom I have every confidence.
Splendid. Well, let's go and have a couple for the tonsils and a pleasant chat. I know a little bar round the corner,
said Lord Ickenham, who, wherever he was, always knew a little bar round the corner.
You have a rather fatigued air, as if putting on all that dog this morning had exhausted you. A whiskey with a splash of soda will soon bring back the sparkle to your eyes.
Seated in the little bar round the corner, Lord Ickenham regarded his companion with some concern.
Yes,
he said.
I was right. You don't look your usual bonny self, very testing these openings of Parliament. Usually I give them a miss, as no doubt you do. What brought you up today?
Connie insisted.
I understand. There are, I should imagine, few finer right and left hand insisters than Lady Constance. A charming woman, of course.
Connie?
Said Lord Emsworth, surprised.
Though perhaps not everybody's cup of tea,
said Lord Ickenham, sensing the incredulity in his companion's voice.
But tell me, how is everything at Blandings Castle? Jogging along nicely, I hope? I always look on that little shack of yours as an earthly paradise.
It was not within Lord Emsworth's power to laugh bitterly, but he uttered a bleating sound which was as near as he could get to a bitter laugh. The description of Blandings Castle as an earthly paradise, with his sister Constance, the Duke, Lavender Briggs, and the Church Lads Brigade running around loose there, struck him as ironical. He mused for a space in silence.
I don't know what to do, Ickenham,
he said, his sombre train of thought coming to its terminus.
You mean now? Have another.
No, thank you. Really, it's very unusual for me to indulge in alcoholic stimulant so early in the day. I was referring to conditions at Blandings Castle.
Not so good?
They are appalling. I have a new secretary, the worst I have ever had. Worse than Baxter.
That seems scarcely credible.
I assure you, a girl of the name of Briggs. She persecutes me.
Get rid of her.
How can I? Connie engaged her, and the Duke of Dunstable is staying at the castle.
What, again?
And the Church Lads Brigade are camping in the park, yelling and squealing all the time. And I am convinced that it was one of them who threw a roll at my top hat.
Your top hat? When did you ever wear a top hat?
It was at the school treat. Connie always makes me wear a top hat at the school treat. I went into the tent at tea time to see that everything was going along all right, and I was passing down the aisle between the tables. A boy threw a crusty roll at my hat and knocked it off. Nothing will persuade me, Ickenham, that the culprit was not one of the church lads.
But you have no evidence that would stand up in a court of law.
Eh? No, none.
Too bad. Well, the whole setup sounds extraordinarily like Devil's Island, and I'm not surprised that you find it difficult to keep the upper lip as stiff as one likes to see upper lips.
A strange light had come into Lord Ickenham's eyes. His nephew Pongo would have recognised it. It was the light which had so often come into them when the other was suggesting that they embark on one of their pleasant and instructive afternoons.
What you need, it seems to me,
he said,
is some rugged ally at your side, someone who will quell the secretary, look Connie in the eye and make her wilt, take the Duke off your hands, and generally spread sweetness and light.
Ah,
said Lord Emsworth with a sigh, as he allowed his mind to dwell on this utopian picture.
Would you like me to come to Blandings?
Lord Emsworth started. His pince-nez, which always dropped off his nose when he was deeply stirred, did an adagio dance at the end of their string.
Would you?
Nothing would please me more. When do you return there?
Tomorrow. This is very good of you, Ickenham.
Not at all. We earls must stick together. There is just one thing. You won't mind if I bring a friend with me? I would not ask you, but he's just back from Brazil, and would be rather lost in London without me.
Brazil? Do people live in Brazil?
Frequently, I believe. This chap has been there some years. He is connected with the Brazil nut industry. I'm a little sketchy as to what his actual job is, but I think he's the fellow who squeezes the nuts in the squeezer to give them that peculiar shape. I may be wrong, of course. Then I bring him with me?
Certainly, certainly, certainly. Delighted, delighted.
A wise decision on your part. Who knows that he may not help the general composition. He might fall in love with the secretary and marry her and take her to Brazil.
True.
Or murder the Duke with some little-known Asiatic poison. Or be of assistance in a number of other ways. I'm sure you'll be glad to have him about the place. He is housebroken and eats whatever you're having yourself. What train are you taking tomorrow?
The 11:45 from Paddington.
Expect us there, my dear Emsworth, said Lord Ickenham. And not only there, but with our hair in a braid, and, speaking for myself, prepare to be up and doing with a heart for any fate. I'll go and ring my friend up now and tell him to start packing.
It was some hours later that Pongo Twistleton, having a tissue restorer before dinner in the Drones Club smoking room, was informed by the smoking room waiter that a gentleman was in the hall asking to see him, and a shadow fell on his tranquil mood. Too often, when gentlemen called asking to see members of the Drones Club, their visits had to do with accounts rendered for goods supplied, with the subject of remittances which would oblige cropping up. And he knew that his own affairs were in a state of some disorder.
"Is he short and stout?"
he asked nervously, remembering that the representative of the Messrs. Hicks and Adrian, to whom he owed a princely sum for shirting, socks and underlinen, could be so described.
"Far from it, tall and beautifully slender,"
said a hearty voice behind him.
"Svelte may be the word I am groping for."
"Oh, hello, Uncle Fred,"
said Pongo, relieved.
"I thought you were someone else."
"Rest assured that I am not. First, last, and all the time, yours to command, Ickenham. I took the liberty of walking in, my dear Pongo, confident that I would receive a nephew's welcome. We Ickenhams dislike to wait in halls. It offends our pride. What's that you're having? Order me one of the same. I suppose it'll harden my arteries, but I like them hard. Bill not with you tonight?"
"No, he had to go to Bottleton East to pick up some things."
"You've not seen him recently?"
No, I haven't been back to the flat. Do you want me to give you dinner?"
"Just what I was about to suggest. It'll be your last opportunity for some little time. I'm off to Blandings Castle tomorrow."
"You're what?"
"Yes. After I left you, I ran into Emsworth, and he asked me to drop down there for a few days, or possibly longer. He's having trouble, poor chap."
"What's wrong with him?"
"Practically everything. He has a new secretary who harries him. The Duke of Dunstable seems to be a fixture on the premises. Lady Constance has pinched his favourite hat and given it to the deserving poor. and he lives in constant fear of her getting away with his shooting jacket with the holes in the elbows. In addition to which, he is much beset by church lads.
Eh?
You see how full my hands will be if I am to help him? I shall have to devise some means of ridding him of this turbulent secretary.
Church lads?
Shipping the Duke back to Wiltshire, where he belongs, curbing Connie, and putting the fear of God into these church lads. An impressive programme, and one that would be beyond the scope of a lesser man. Most fortunately, I am not a lesser man.
How do you mean, church lads?
Weren't you ever a church lad?
No.
Well, many of the younger generation are. They assemble in gangs in most rural parishes. The Church Lads Brigade, they call themselves. Connie has allowed them to camp out by the lake.
And Emsworth doesn't like them?
Nobody could, except their mothers. No, he eyes them askance. They ruin the scenery, poison the air with their uncouth cries, and at the recent school treat, so he tells me, knocked off his top hat with a crusty roll.
Pongo shook his head censoriously.
He shouldn't have worn a topper at a school treat, he said.
He was remembering functions of this kind into which he had been lured at one time and another by clergymen's daughters for whose charms he had fallen. The one at Maiden Eggersford in Somerset, when his great love for Angelica Briscoe, daughter of the Reverend P.P. Briscoe, who vetted the souls of the peasantry in that hamlet, had led him to put his head in a sack and allow himself to be prodded with sticks by the younger set, had never been erased from his memory.
A topper! Good Lord! Just asking for it!
He acted under duress. He would have preferred to wear a cloth cap, but Connie insisted. You know how persuasive she can be?
She's a tough baby.
Very tough. Let us hope she takes to Bill Bailey.
Does what?
Oh, I didn't tell you, did I? Bill is accompanying me to Blandings.
What?
Yes. Emsworth very kindly included him in his invitation. We're off tomorrow on the 11:45, singing a gypsy song.
Horror leapt into Pongo's eyes. He started violently and came within an ace of spilling his martini with a spot of lemon peel in it. Fond though he was of his Uncle Fred, he had never wavered in his view that, in the interests of young English manhood, he ought to be kept on a chain and seldom allowed at large.
But, my gosh!
Something troubling you?
You can't... What's the word? You can't subject poor old Bill to this frightful ordeal?
Lord Ickenham's eyebrows rose.
Well, really, Pongo, if you consider it an ordeal for a young man to be in the same house with the girl he loves, you must have less sentiment in you than I had supposed.
Yes, that's all very well. His ball of fluff will be there, I agree. But what good's that going to do him when 2 minutes after his arrival, Lady Constance grabs him by the seat of the trousers and heaves him out?
I anticipate no such contingency. You seem to have a very odd idea of the sort of thing that goes on at Blandings Castle, my boy. You appear to look on that refined home as a kind of bowery saloon, with bodies being hurled through the swing doors all the time and bounced along the sidewalk. Nothing of that nature will occur. We shall be like a great big family. Peace and goodwill everywhere. Too bad you won't be with us.
I'm all right here, thanks,
said Pongo, with a slight shudder as he recalled some of the high spots of his previous visit to the castle.
But I still maintain that when Lady Constance hears the name Bailey...
But she won't. You don't suppose a shrewd man like myself would have overlooked a point like that? He's calling himself Cuthbert Merryweather. I told him to write it down and memorize it.
She'll find out.
Not a chance. Who's going to tell her?
Pongo gave up the struggle. He knew the futility of arguing. and he had just perceived the bright side of the situation, to wit that, after tomorrow, more than 100 miles would separate him from his amiable but hair-bleaching relative. The thought was a very heartening one. Going by the form book, he took it for granted that ere many suns had set, the old buster would be up to some kind of hell which would ultimately stagger civilization and turn the moon to blood. But what mattered was that he would be up to it at Lord Emsworth's rural seat, and not in London. How right he felt, the author of the well-known hymn had been, in saying that peace, perfect peace, is to be attained only when loved ones are far away.
"Let's go in and have some dinner," he said.